Since there may have been more interplanetary debris a few billion years ago than there is today, we might have to wait even longer than 100,000 years to see a crater form on the moon. Because the Earth has a larger area than the moon, we might have to wait something like 10,000 years between collisions that would make craters as big as a kilometer across on our planet. And since Meteor Crater Arizona, an impact crater about a kilometer across, has been found to be 20 or 30,000 years old, the observations on the Earth are in agreement with such crude calculations. The actual impact of a small comet or asteroid with the moon might make a momentary explosion sufficiently bright to be visible from the Earth. We can imagine our ancestors gazing idly up on some night 100,000 years ago and noting a strange cloud arising from the unilluminated part of the moon, suddenly struck by the sun's rays. But we would not expect such an event to have happened in historical times. The odds against it must be something like 100 to 1. And nevertheless, there is an historical account which may in fact describe an impact on the moon seen from Earth with the naked eye. On the evening of June 25th, 1178, five British monks reported something extraordinary, which was later recorded in the Chronicle of Gervase of Canterbury, generally considered a reliable reporter on the political and cultural events of his time, after he had interviewed the eyewitnesses who asserted under oath the truth of their story. The chronicle reads, "There was a bright new moon, and as usual, in that phase, its horns were tilted toward the east. Suddenly, the upper horn split in two. From the midpoint of the division, a flaming torch sprang up, spewing out fire, hot coals, and sparks." The astronomers Dural Mulholland and Odile Kalam have calculated that a lunar impact would produce a dust cloud rising off the surface of the moon with an appearance corresponding rather closely to the report of the Canterbury monks. If such an impact were made only 800 years ago, the crater should still be visible. Erosion on the moon is so inefficient because of the absence of air and water that even small craters, a few billion years old, are still comparatively well preserved. From the description recorded by Gervase, it is possible to pinpoint the sector of the moon to which the observations refer. Impacts produce rays, linear trails of fine powder spewed out during the explosion. Such rays are associated with the very youngest craters on the moon. For example, those named after Aristarchus and Copernicus and Kepler. But while the craters may withstand erosion on the moon, the rays, being exceptionally thin, do not. As time goes on, even the arrival of micrometeorites, fine dust from space, stirs up and covers over the rays, and they gradually disappear. Thus, rays are a signature of a recent impact. The meteoriticist Jack Hartung has pointed out that a very recent, very fresh-looking small crater with a prominent ray system lies exactly in the region of the moon referred to by the Canterbury monks. It is called Giordano Bruno, after the 16th-century Roman Catholic scholar who held that there are an infinity of worlds and that many are inhabited. For this and other crimes, he was burned at the stake in the year 1600. Another line of evidence consistent with this interpretation has been provided by Kalam and Mulholland. When an object impacts the moon at high speed, it sets the moon slightly wobbling. Eventually, the vibrations die down, but not in so short a period as 800 years. Such a quivering can be studied by laser reflection techniques. The Apollo astronauts emplaced in several locales on the moon special mirrors called laser retroreflectors. When a laser beam from Earth strikes the mirror and bounces back, the round-trip travel time can be measured with remarkable precision. This time, multiplied by the speed of light, gives us the distance to the moon at that moment to equally remarkable precision. Such measurements, performed over a period of years, reveal the moon to be librating or quivering with a period, about 3 years, and amplitude, about 3 meters, consistent with the idea that the crater Giordano Bruno was gouged out less than 1,000 years ago. All this evidence is inferential, and indirect. The odds, as I have said, are against such an event happening in historical times. But the evidence is at least suggestive. As the Tunguska event and meteor crater Arizona also remind us, not all impact catastrophes occurred in the early history of the solar system. But the fact that only a few of the lunar craters have extensive ray systems also reminds us that, even on the moon, some erosion occurs. By noting which craters overlap which, and other signs of lunar stratigraphy, we can reconstruct the sequence of impact and flooding events of which the production of Crater Bruno is perhaps the most recent example. The Earth is very near the moon. If the moon is so severely cratered by impacts, how has the Earth avoided them? Why is meteor crater so rare? Do the comets and asteroids think it inadvisable to impact an inhabited planet? This is an unlikely forbearance. The only possible explanation is that impact craters are formed at very similar rates on both the Earth and the moon, but that on the airless, waterless moon, they are preserved for immense periods of time, while on the Earth, slow erosion wipes them out or fills them in. Running water, wind-blown sand, and mountain building are very slow processes, but over millions or billions of years, they are capable of utterly erasing even very large impact scars. On the surface of any moon or planet, there will be external processes, such as impacts from space, and internal processes, such as earthquakes. There will be fast, catastrophic events, such as volcanic explosions, and processes of excruciating slowness, such as the pitting of a surface by tiny airborne sand grains. There is no general answer to the question of which processes dominate, the outside ones or the inside ones, the rare but violent events or the common and inconspicuous occurrences. On the moon, the outside, catastrophic events hold sway. On Earth, the inside, slow processes dominate. Mars is an intermediate case. Between the orbits of Mars and Jupiter are countless asteroids, tiny terrestrial planets. The largest are a few hundred kilometers across. Many have oblong shapes and are tumbling through space. In some cases, there seem to be two or more asteroids in tight mutual orbits. Collisions among the asteroids happen frequently, and occasionally, a piece is chipped off and accidentally intercepts the Earth, falling to the ground as a meteorite. In the exhibits, on the shelves of our museums, are the fragments of distant worlds. The asteroid belt is a great grinding mill, producing smaller and smaller pieces down to motes of dust. The bigger asteroidal pieces, along with the comets, are mainly responsible for the recent craters on planetary surfaces. The asteroid belt may be a place where a planet was once prevented from forming because of the gravitational tides of the giant nearby planet Jupiter, or it may be the shattered remains of a planet that blew itself up. This seems improbable because no scientist on Earth knows how a planet might blow itself up, which is probably just as well. The rings of Saturn bear some resemblance to the asteroid belt, trillions of tiny, icy moonlets orbiting the planet. They may represent debris prevented by the gravity of Saturn from accreting into a nearby moon, or they may be the remains of a moon that wandered too close and was torn apart by the gravitational tides. Alternatively, they may be the steady state equilibrium between material ejected from a moon of Saturn, such as Titan, and material falling into the atmosphere of the planet. Jupiter and Uranus also have ring systems, discovered only recently and almost invisible from the Earth. Whether Neptune has a ring is a problem high on the agenda of planetary scientists. Rings may be a typical adornment of Jovian-type planets throughout the cosmos. Major recent collisions from Saturn to Venus were alleged in a popular book, Worlds in Collision, published in 1950 by a psychiatrist named Emanuel Velikovsky. He proposed that an object of planetary mass, which he called a comet, was somehow generated in the Jupiter system. Some 3,500 years ago, it careered in toward the inner solar system and made repeated encounters with the Earth and Mars, having as incidental consequences the parting of the Red Sea, allowing Moses and the Israelites to escape from Pharaoh and the stopping of the earth from rotating on Joshua's command. It also caused, he said, extensive volcanism and floods. Velikovsky imagined the comet, after a complicated game of interplanetary billiards, to settle down into a stable, nearly circular orbit, becoming the planet Venus, which he claimed never existed before then. As I have discussed at some length elsewhere, these ideas are almost certainly wrong. Astronomers do not object to the idea of major collisions, only to major recent collisions. In any model of the solar system, it is impossible to show the sizes of the planets on the same scale as their orbits because the planets would then be almost too small to see. If the planets were really shown to scale as grains of dust, we would easily note that the chance of collision of a particular comet with the Earth in a few thousand years is extraordinarily low. Moreover, Venus is a rocky and metallic hydrogen-poor planet, whereas Jupiter, where Velikovsky supposed it comes from, is made almost entirely of hydrogen. There are no energy sources for comets or planets to be ejected by Jupiter. If one passed by the Earth, it could not stop the Earth's rotation, much less start it up again at 24 hours a day. No geological evidence supports the idea of an unusual frequency of volcanism or floods 3,500 years ago. There are Mesopotamian inscriptions referring to Venus that predate the time when Velikovsky says Venus changed from a comet into a planet. It is very unlikely that an object in such a highly elliptical orbit could be rapidly moved into the nearly perfectly circular orbit of present-day Venus, and so on. Many hypotheses proposed by scientists as well as by non-scientists turn out to be wrong. But science is a self-correcting enterprise. To be accepted, all new ideas must survive rigorous standards of evidence. The worst aspect of the Velikovsky affair is not that his hypotheses were wrong or in contradiction to firmly established facts, but that some who called themselves scientists attempted to suppress Velikovsky's work. Science is generated by and devoted to free inquiry. The idea that any hypothesis, no matter how strange, deserves to be considered on its merits. The suppression of uncomfortable ideas may be common in religion and politics, but it is not the path to knowledge. It has no place in the endeavor of science. We do not know in advance who will discover fundamental new insights. Venus has almost the same mass, size, and density as the Earth. As the nearest planet, it has for centuries been thought of as the Earth's sister. What is our sister planet really like? Might it be a balmy summer planet, a little warmer than the Earth because it is a little closer to the sun? Does it have impact craters, or have they all eroded away? Are there volcanoes, mountains, oceans, life? The first person to look at Venus through the telescope was Galileo in 1609. He saw an absolutely featureless disk. Galileo noted that it went through phases, like the moon, from a thin crescent to a full disk, and for the same reason, we are sometimes looking mostly at the night side of Venus and sometimes mostly at the day side, a finding that incidentally reinforced the view that the Earth went around the sun and not vice versa. As optical telescopes became larger and their resolution, or ability to discriminate fine detail, improved, they were systematically turned toward Venus. But they did no better than Galileo's. Venus was evidently covered by a dense layer of obscuring cloud. When we look at the planet in the morning or evening skies, we are seeing sunlight reflected off the clouds of Venus. But for centuries after their discovery, the composition of those clouds remained entirely unknown. The absence of anything to see on Venus led some scientists to the curious conclusion that the surface was a swamp, like the Earth in the Carboniferous period. The argument, if we can dignify it by such a word, went something like this. I can't see a thing on Venus. Why not? Because it's totally covered with clouds. What are clouds made of? Water, of course. Then why are the clouds of Venus thicker than the clouds on Earth? Because there's more water there. But if there's more water in the clouds, there must be more water on the surface. What kind of surfaces are very wet? Swamps. And if there are swamps, why not cycads and dragonflies and perhaps even dinosaurs on Venus? Observation. There was absolutely nothing to see on Venus. Conclusion? It must be covered with life. The featureless clouds of Venus reflected our own predispositions. We are alive, and we resonate with the idea of life elsewhere. But only careful accumulation and assessment of the evidence can tell us whether a given world is inhabited. Venus turns out not to oblige our predispositions. The first real clue to the nature of Venus came from work with a prism made of glass or a flat surface called a diffraction grating, covered with fine, regularly spaced ruled lines. When an intense beam of ordinary white light passes through a narrow slit and then through a prism or grating, it is spread into a rainbow of colors called a spectrum. The spectrum runs from high frequencies of visible light to low ones, violet, blue, green, yellow, orange, and red. Since we see these colors, it is called the spectrum of visible light. But there is far more light than the small segment of the spectrum we can see. At higher frequencies, beyond the violet, is a part of the spectrum called the ultraviolet, a perfectly real kind of light carrying death to the microbes. It is invisible to us, but readily detectable by bumblebees and photoelectric cells. There is much more to the world than we can see. Beyond the ultraviolet is the X-ray part of the spectrum, and beyond the X-ray are the gamma rays. At lower frequencies, on the other side of red, is the infrared part of the spectrum. It was first discovered by placing a sensitive thermometer in what, to our eyes, is the dark beyond the red. The temperature rose. There was light falling on the thermometer, even though it was invisible to our eyes. Rattlesnakes and doped semiconductors detect infrared radiation perfectly well. Beyond the infrared is the vast spectral region of the radio waves. From gamma rays to radio waves, all are equally respectable bands of light. All are useful in astronomy. But because of the limitations of our eyes, we have a prejudice, a bias toward that tiny rainbow band we call the spectrum of visible light. In 1844, the philosopher Auguste Comte was searching for an example of a sort of knowledge that would be always hidden. He chose the composition of distant stars and planets. We would never physically visit them, he thought, and with no sample in hand, it seemed we would forever be denied knowledge of their composition. But only 3 years after Comte's death, it was discovered that a spectrum can be used to determine the chemistry of distant objects. Different molecules and chemical elements absorb different frequencies or colors of light, sometimes in the visible and sometimes elsewhere in the spectrum. In the spectrum of a planetary atmosphere, a single dark line represents an image of the slit in which light is missing, the absorption of sunlight during its brief passage through the air of another world. Each such line is made by a particular kind of molecule or atom. Every substance has its characteristic spectral signature. The gases on Venus can be identified from Earth 60 million kilometers away. We can divine the composition of the sun, in which helium, named after the Greek sun god Helios, was first found, of magnetic A stars rich in europium, of distant galaxies analyzed through the collective light of 100 billion constituent stars. Astronomical spectroscopy is an almost magical technique. It amazes me still. Auguste Comte picked a particularly unfortunate example. If Venus were soaking wet, it should be easy to see the water vapor lines in its spectrum. But the first spectroscopic searches attempted at Mount Wilson Observatory around 1920, found not a hint, not a trace of water vapor above the clouds of Venus, suggesting an arid, desert-like surface surmounted by clouds of fine, drifting silicate dust. Further study revealed enormous quantities of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, implying to some scientists that all the water on the planet had combined with hydrocarbons to form carbon dioxide, and that therefore the surface of Venus was a global oil field, a planet-wide sea of petroleum. Others concluded that there was no water vapor above the clouds because the clouds were very cold, that all the water had condensed out into water droplets, which do not have the same pattern of spectral lines as water vapor. They suggested that the planet was totally covered with water, except perhaps for an occasional limestone-encrusted island, like the cliffs of Dover. But because of the vast quantities of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, the sea could not be ordinary water. Physical chemistry required carbonated water. Venus, they proposed, had a vast ocean of seltzer. The first hint of the true situation came not from spectroscopic studies in the visible or near-infrared parts of the spectrum, but rather from the radio region. A radio telescope works more like a light meter than a camera. You point it toward some fairly broad region of the sky, and it records how much energy in a particular radio frequency is coming down to Earth. We are used to radio signals transmitted by some varieties of intelligent life, namely those who run radio and television stations. But there are many other reasons for natural objects to give off radio waves. One is that they are hot. And when, in 1956, an early radio telescope was turned toward Venus, it was discovered to be emitting radio waves as if it were at an extremely high temperature. But the real demonstration that the surface of Venus is astonishingly hot came when the Soviet spacecraft of the Venera series first penetrated the obscuring clouds and landed on the mysterious and inaccessible surface of the nearest planet. Venus, it turns out, is broiling hot. There are no swamps, no oil fields, no seltzer oceans. With insufficient data, it is easy to go wrong. When I greet a friend, I am seeing her in reflected, visible light generated by the sun, say, or by an incandescent lamp. The light rays bounce off my friend and into my eye. But the ancients, including no less a figure than Euclid, believe that we see by virtue of rays somehow emitted by the eye and tangibly, actively, contacting the object observed. This is a natural notion and can still be encountered, although it does not account for the invisibility of objects in a darkened room. Today, we combine a laser and a photocell, or a radar transmitter and a radio telescope, and in this way, make active contact by light with distant objects. In radar astronomy, radio waves are transmitted by a telescope on Earth, strike, say, the hemisphere of Venus that happens to be facing the Earth, and bounce back. At many wavelengths, the clouds and atmosphere of Venus are entirely transparent to radio waves. Some places on the surface will absorb them, or if they are very rough, will scatter them sideways and so will appear dark to radio waves. By following the surface features moving with Venus as it rotates, it was possible for the first time to determine reliably the length of its day, how long it takes Venus to spin once on its axis. It turns out that, with respect to the stars, Venus turns once every 243 Earth days, but backward, in the opposite direction from all other planets in the inner solar system. As a result, the sun rises in the west and sets in the east, taking 118 Earth days from sunrise to sunrise. What is more, it presents almost exactly the same face to the Earth each time it is closest to our planet. However the Earth's gravity has managed to nudge Venus into this Earth-locked rotation rate, it cannot have happened rapidly. Venus could not be a mere few thousand years old, but rather it must be as old as all the other objects in the inner solar system. Radar pictures of Venus have been obtained, some from ground-based radar telescopes, some from the Pioneer Venus vehicle in orbit around the planet. They show provocative evidence of impact craters. There are just as many craters that are not too big or too small on Venus as there are in the lunar highlands, so many that Venus is again telling us that it is very old. But the craters of Venus are remarkably shallow, almost as if the high surface temperatures have produced a kind of rock that flows over long periods of time, like taffy or putty, gradually softening the relief. There are great mesas here, twice as high as the Tibetan Plateau, an immense rift valley, possibly giant volcanoes, and a mountain as high as Everest. We now see before us a world previously hidden entirely by clouds, its features first explored by radar and by space vehicles. The surface temperatures on Venus, as deduced from radio astronomy and confirmed by direct spacecraft measurements, are around 480 degrees centigrade or 900 degrees Fahrenheit, hotter than the hottest household oven. The corresponding surface pressure is 90 atmospheres, 90 times the pressure we feel from the Earth's atmosphere, the equivalent of the weight of water 1 kilometer below the surface of the oceans. To survive for long on Venus, a space vehicle would have to be refrigerated as well as built like a deep submersible. Something like a dozen space vehicles from the Soviet Union and the United States have entered the dense Venus atmosphere and penetrated the clouds. A few of them have actually survived for an hour or so on the surface. Two spacecraft in the Soviet Venera series have taken pictures down there. Let us follow in the footsteps of these pioneering missions and visit another world. In ordinary, visible light, the faintly yellowish clouds of Venus can be made out, but they show, as Galileo first noted, virtually no features at all. If the cameras look in the ultraviolet, however, we see a graceful, complex, swirling weather system in the high atmosphere, where the winds are around 100 meters per second, some 220 miles per hour. The atmosphere of Venus is composed of 96% carbon dioxide. There are small traces of nitrogen, water vapor, argon, carbon monoxide, and other gases, but the only hydrocarbons, or carbohydrates, present are there in less than 0.1 parts per million. The clouds of Venus turn out to be chiefly a concentrated solution of sulfuric acid. Small quantities of hydrochloric acid and hydrofluoric acid are also present. Even at its high, cool clouds, Venus turns out to be a thoroughly nasty place. High above the visible cloud deck, at about 70 kilometers altitude, there is a continuous haze of small particles. At 60 kilometers, we plunge into the clouds and find ourselves surrounded by droplets of concentrated sulfuric acid. As we go deeper, the cloud particles tend to get bigger. The pungent gas, sulfur dioxide, SO2, is present in trace amounts in the lower atmosphere. It is circulated up above the clouds, broken down by ultraviolet light from the sun, and recombined with water there to form sulfuric acid, which condenses into droplets, settles, and at lower altitudes is broken down by heat into SO2 and water again, completing the cycle. It is always raining sulfuric acid on Venus, all over the planet, and not a drop ever reaches the surface. The sulfur-colored mist extends downward to some 45 kilometers above the surface of Venus, where we emerge into a dense but crystal-clear atmosphere. The atmospheric pressure is so high, however, that we cannot see the surface. Sunlight is bounced about by atmospheric molecules until we lose all images from the surface. There is no dust here, no clouds, just an atmosphere getting palpably denser. Plenty of sunlight is transmitted by the overlying clouds, about as much as on an overcast day on the Earth. With searing heat, crushing pressures, noxious gases, and everything suffused in an eerie reddish glow, Venus seems less the goddess of love than the incarnation of hell. As nearly as we can make out, at least Some places on the surface are strewn fields of jumbled, softened, irregular rocks, a hostile, barren landscape relieved only here and there by the eroded remnants of a derelict spacecraft from a distant planet, utterly invisible through the thick, cloudy, poisonous atmosphere. In this stifling landscape, there is not likely to be anything alive, even creatures very different from us. Organic and other conceivable biological molecules would simply fall to pieces. But, as an indulgence, let us imagine that intelligent life once evolved on such a planet. Would it then invent science? The development of science on Earth was spurred fundamentally by observations of the regularities of the stars and planets. But Venus is completely cloud-covered. The night is pleasingly long, about 59 Earth days long, but nothing of the astronomical universe would be visible if you looked up into the night sky of Venus. Even the sun would be invisible in the daytime. Its light would be scattered and diffused over the whole sky, just as scuba divers see only a uniform enveloping radiance beneath the sea. If a radio telescope were built on Venus, it could detect the sun, the Earth, and other distant objects. If astrophysics developed, the existence of stars could eventually be deduced from the principles of physics, but they would be theoretical constructs only. I sometimes wonder what their reaction would be if intelligent beings on Venus one day learned to fly, to sail in the dense air, to penetrate the mysterious cloud veil 45 kilometers above them, and eventually to emerge out the top of the clouds, to look up, and for the first time witness that glorious universe of sun and planets and stars. Venus is a kind of planet-wide catastrophe. It now seems reasonably clear that the high surface temperature comes about through a massive greenhouse effect. Sunlight passes through the atmosphere and clouds of Venus, which are semi-transparent to visible light, and reaches the surface. The surface, being heated, endeavors to radiate back into space. But because Venus is much cooler than the sun, it emits radiation chiefly in the infrared rather than the visible region of the spectrum. However, the carbon dioxide and water vapor in the Venus atmosphere are almost perfectly opaque to infrared radiation. The heat of the sun is efficiently trapped, and the surface temperature rises until the little amount of infrared radiation that trickles out of this massive atmosphere just balances the sunlight absorbed in the lower atmosphere and surface. Our neighboring world turns out to be a dismally unpleasant place. But we will go back to Venus. It is fascinating in its own right. Many mythic heroes in Greek and Norse mythology, after all, made celebrated efforts to visit hell. There is also much to be learned about our planet, a comparative heaven, by comparing it with hell. The Sphinx, half human, half lion, was constructed more than 5,500 years ago. Its face was once crisp and cleanly rendered. It is now softened and blurred by thousands of years of Egyptian desert sandblasting and by occasional rains. In New York City, there is an obelisk called Cleopatra's Needle, which came from Egypt. In only about 100 years in that city's Central Park, its inscriptions have been almost totally obliterated because of smog and industrial pollution, chemical erosion like that in the atmosphere of Venus. Erosion on Earth slowly wipes out information, but because they are gradual, the patter of a raindrop, the sting of a sand grain, those processes can be missed. Big structures, such as mountain ranges, survive tens of millions of years. Smaller impact craters, perhaps 100,000, and large-scale human artifacts, only some thousands. In addition to such slow and uniform erosion, destruction also occurs through catastrophes, large and small. The Sphinx is missing a nose. Someone shot it off in a moment of idle desecration. Some say it was Mameluke Turks, others Napoleonic soldiers. On Venus, on Earth, and elsewhere in the solar system, there is evidence for catastrophic destruction tempered or overwhelmed by slower, more uniform processes. On the Earth, for example, rainfall coursing into rivulets, streams, and rivers of running water, creating huge alluvial basins. On Mars, the remnants of ancient rivers, perhaps arising from beneath the ground. On Io, a moon of Jupiter, what seemed to be broad channels made by flowing liquid sulfur. There are mighty weather systems on the Earth and in the high atmosphere of Venus and on Jupiter. There are sandstorms on the Earth and on Mars, lightning on Jupiter and Venus and Earth. Volcanoes inject debris into the atmospheres of the Earth and Io. Internal geological processes slowly deform the surfaces of Venus, Mars, Ganymede, and Europa, as well as Earth. Glaciers, proverbial for their slowness, produce major reworkings of landscapes on Earth and probably also on Mars. These processes need not be constant in time. Most of Europe was once covered with ice. A few million years ago, the present site of the city of Chicago was buried under 3 kilometers of frost. On Mars and elsewhere in the solar system, we see features that could not be produced today. Landscapes carved hundreds of millions or billions of years ago when the planetary climate was probably very different. There is an additional factor that can alter the landscape and the climate of Earth. Intelligent life, able to make major environmental changes. Like Venus, the Earth also has a greenhouse effect due to its carbon dioxide and water vapor. The global temperature of the Earth would be below the freezing point of water if not for the greenhouse effect. It keeps the oceans liquid and life possible. A little greenhouse is a good thing. Like Venus, the Earth also has about 90 atmospheres of carbon dioxide, but it resides in the crust as limestone and other carbonates, not in the atmosphere. If the Earth were moved only a little closer to the sun, the temperature would increase slightly. This would drive some of the CO2 out of the surface rocks, generating a stronger greenhouse effect, which would in turn incrementally heat the surface further. A hotter surface would vaporize still more carbonates in the CO2, and there would be the possibility of a runaway greenhouse effect to very high temperatures. This is just what we think happened in the early history of Venus, because of Venus's proximity to the sun. The surface environment of Venus is a warning. Something disastrous can happen to a planet rather like our own. The principal energy sources of our present industrial civilization are the so-called fossil fuels. We burn wood and oil, coal and natural gas, and, in the process, release waste gases, principally CO2, into the air. Consequently, the carbon dioxide content of the Earth's atmosphere is increasing dramatically. The possibility of a runaway greenhouse effect suggests that we have to be careful. Even a 1 or 2 degree rise in the global temperature can have catastrophic consequences. In the burning of coal and oil and gasoline, we are also putting sulfuric acid into the atmosphere. Like Venus, our stratosphere even now has a substantial mist of tiny sulfuric acid droplets. Our major cities are polluted with noxious molecules. We do not understand the long-term effects of our course of action, but we have also been perturbing the climate in the opposite sense. For hundreds of thousands of years, human beings have been burning and cutting down forests and encouraging domestic animals to graze on and destroy grasslands. Slash-and-burn agriculture, industrial tropical deforestation, and overgrazing are rampant today. But forests are darker than grasslands, and grasslands are darker than deserts. As a consequence, the amount of sunlight that is absorbed by the ground has been declining, and by changes in the land use, we are lowering the surface temperature of our planet. Might this cooling increase the size of the polar ice cap, which, because it is bright, will reflect still more sunlight from the Earth, further cooling the planet, driving a runaway albedo effect? The albedo is the fraction of the sunlight striking a planet that is reflected back to space. The albedo of the Earth is some 30 to 35%. The rest of the sunlight is absorbed by the ground and is responsible for the average surface temperature. Our lovely blue planet, the Earth, is the only home we know. Venus is too hot. Mars is too cold. But the Earth is just right. A heaven for humans. After all, we evolved here. But our congenial climate may be unstable. We are perturbing our poor planet in serious and contradictory ways. Is there any danger of driving the environment of the Earth toward the planetary hell of Venus or the global ice age of Mars? The simple answer is that nobody knows. The study of the global climate, the comparison of the Earth with other worlds, are subjects in their earliest stages of development. They are fields that are poorly and grudgingly funded. In our ignorance, we continue to push and pull to pollute the atmosphere and brighten the land, oblivious of the fact that the long-term consequences are largely unknown. A few million years ago, when human beings first evolved on Earth, it was already a middle-aged world, 4.6 billion years along from the catastrophes and impetuosities of its youth. But we humans now represent a new and perhaps decisive factor. Our intelligence and our technology have given us the power to affect the climate. How will we use this power? Are we willing to tolerate ignorance and complacency in matters that affect the entire human family? Do we value short-term advantages above the welfare of the Earth? Or will we think on longer timescales with concern for our children and our grandchildren to understand and protect the complex life support systems of our planet? The Earth is a tiny and fragile world. It needs to be cherished. Chapter 5. Blues for a Red Planet. In the orchards of the gods, he watches the canals. Enuma Elish, Sumer, circa 2500 BC. A man that is of Copernicus's opinion that this Earth of ours is a planet carried round and enlightened by the sun, like the rest of them, cannot but sometimes have a fancy that the rest of the planets have their dress and furniture, nay, and their inhabitants too, as well as this Earth of ours. But we were always apt to conclude that 'twas in vain to inquire after what nature had been pleased to do there, seeing there was no likelihood of ever coming to an end of the inquiry. But a while ago, thinking somewhat seriously on this matter, not that I count myself quicker-sighted than those great men of the past, but that I had the happiness to live after most of them, methoughts the inquiry was not so impracticable, nor the way so stopped up with difficulties, but that there was very good room left for probable conjectures. Christian Huygens' New Conjectures Concerning the Planetary Worlds, Their Inhabitants and Productions, circa 1690. Many years ago, so the story goes, a celebrated newspaper publisher sent a telegram to a noted astronomer. Wire, collect immediately 500 words on whether there is life on Mars. The astronomer dutifully replied, "Nobody knows, nobody knows, nobody knows," 250 times. But despite this confession of ignorance, asserted with dogged persistence by an expert, no one paid any heed. And from that time to this, we hear authoritative pronouncements by those who think they have deduced life on Mars, and by those who think they have excluded it. Some people very much want there to be life on Mars. Others very much want there to be no life on Mars. There have been excesses in both camps. These strong passions have somewhat frayed the tolerance for ambiguity that is essential to science. There seem to be many people who simply wish to be told an answer, any answer, and thereby avoid the burden of keeping two mutually exclusive possibilities in their heads at the same time. Some scientists have believed that Mars is inhabited on what has later proved to be the flimsiest evidence. Others have concluded the planet is lifeless because a preliminary search for a particular manifestation of life has been unsuccessful or ambiguous. The blues have been played more than once for the red planet. Why Martians? Why so many eager speculations and ardent fantasies about Martians, rather than, say, Saturnians or Plutonians? Because Mars seems, at first glance, very Earth-like. It is the nearest planet whose surface we can see. There are polar ice caps, drifting white clouds, raging dust storms, seasonally changing patterns on its red surface, even a 24-hour day. It is tempting to think of it as an inhabited world. Mars has become a kind of mythic arena onto which we have projected our earthly hopes and fears. But our psychological predispositions, pro or con, must not mislead us. All that matters is the evidence, and the evidence is not yet in. The real Mars is a world of wonders. Its future prospects are far more intriguing than our past apprehensions about it. In our time, we have sifted the sands of Mars, we have established a presence there. We have fulfilled a century of dreams. No one would have believed in the last years of the 19th century that this world was being watched keenly and closely by intelligences greater than man's, and yet as mortal as his own, that as men busied themselves about their various concerns, they were scrutinized and studied, perhaps almost as narrowly as a man with a microscope might scrutinize the transient creatures that swarm and multiply in a drop of water. With infinite complacency, men went to and fro over this globe about their little affairs, serene in their assurances of their empire over matter. It is possible that the infusoria under the microscope do the same. No one gave a thought to the older worlds of space as sources of human danger, or thought of them only to dismiss the idea of life upon them as impossible or improbable. It is curious to recall some of the mental habits of those departed days. At most, terrestrial men fancied there might be other men upon Mars, perhaps inferior to themselves and ready to welcome a missionary enterprise. Yet, across the gulf of space, minds that are to our minds as ours are to those of the beasts that perish, intellects vast and cool and unsympathetic, regarded this earth with envious eyes, and slowly and surely drew their plans against us. These opening lines of H.G. Wells' 1897 science fiction classic, The War of the Worlds, maintain their haunting power to this day. In 1938, a radio version produced by Orson Welles transposed the Martian invasion from England to the eastern United States and frightened millions in war-jittery America into believing that the Martians were, in fact, attacking. For all of our history, there has been the fear or hope that there might be life beyond the Earth. In the last 100 years, that premonition has focused on a bright red point of light in the night sky. 3 years before The War of the Worlds was published, a Bostonian named Percival Lowell founded a major observatory where the most elaborate claims in support of life on Mars were developed. Lowell dabbled in astronomy as a young man, went to Harvard, secured a semi-official diplomatic appointment to Korea, and otherwise engaged in the usual pursuits of the wealthy. Before he died in 1916, he had made major contributions to our knowledge of the nature and evolution of the planets, to the deduction of the expanding universe, and in a decisive way, to the discovery of the planet Pluto, which is named after him. The first two letters of the name Pluto are the initials of Percival Lowell. But Lowell's lifelong love was the planet Mars. He was electrified by the announcement in 1877 by an Italian astronomer, Giovanni Schiaparelli, of Canali on Mars. Schiaparelli had reported during a close approach of Mars to Earth an intricate network of single and double straight lines crisscrossing the bright areas of the planet. Canali, in Italian, means channels or grooves, but was promptly translated into English as canals, a word that implies intelligent design. A Mars mania coursed through Europe and America, and Lowell found himself swept up with it. In 1892, his eyesight failing, Schiaparelli announced he was giving up observing Mars. Lowell resolved to continue the work. He wanted a first-rate observing site, undisturbed by clouds or city lights and marked by good seeing, the astronomer's term for a steady atmosphere through which the shimmering of an astronomical image in the telescope is minimized. Bad seeing is produced by small-scale turbulence in the atmosphere above the telescope and is the reason the stars twinkle. Lowell built his observatory far away from home, on Mars Hill, in Flagstaff, Arizona. He sketched the surface features of Mars, particularly the canals, which mesmerized him. Observations of this sort are not easy. You put in long hours at the telescope, in the chill of the early morning. Often, the seeing is poor, and the image of Mars blurs and distorts. Then, you must ignore what you have seen. Occasionally, the image steadies, and the features of the planet flash out momentarily, marvelously. You must then remember what has been vouchsafed to you and accurately committed to paper. You must put your preconceptions aside and, with an open mind, set down the wonders of Mars. Percival Lowell's notebooks are full of what he thought he saw. Bright and dark areas, a hint of a polar cap, and canals, a planet festooned with canals. Lowell believed he was seeing a globe-girdling network of great irrigation ditches carrying water from the melting polar caps to the thirsty inhabitants of the equatorial cities. He believed the planet to be inhabited by an older and wiser race, perhaps very different from us. He believed that the seasonal changes in the dark areas were due to the growth and decay of vegetation. He believed that Mars was very closely Earth-like. All in all, he believed too much. Lowell conjured up a Mars that was ancient, arid, withered, a desert world. Still, it was an Earth-like desert. Lowell's Mars had many features in common with the American Southwest, where the Lowell Observatory was located. He imagined the Martian temperatures a little on the chilly side, but still as comfortable as the south of England. The air was thin, but there was enough oxygen to be breathable. Water was rare, but the elegant network of canals carried the life-giving fluid all over the planet. What was, in retrospect, the most serious contemporary challenge to Lowell's ideas came from an unlikely source. In 1907, Alfred Russel Wallace, co-discoverer of evolution by natural selection, was asked to review one of Lowell's books. He had been an engineer in his youth, and while somewhat credulous on such issues as extrasensory perception, was admirably skeptical on the habitability of Mars. Wallace showed that Lowell had erred in his calculation of the average temperatures on Mars. Instead of being as temperate as the south of England, they were, with few exceptions, everywhere below the freezing point of water. There should be permafrost, a perpetually frozen subsurface. The air was much thinner than Lowell had calculated. Craters should be as abundant as on the moon. And as for the water in the canals, any attempt to make that scanty surplus of water by means of overflowing canals, travel across the equator into the opposite hemisphere through such terrible desert regions and exposed to such a cloudless sky as Mr. Lowell describes, would be the work of a body of madmen rather than of intelligent beings. It may be safely asserted that not one drop of water would escape evaporation or insoak at even 100 miles from its source. This devastating and largely correct physical analysis was written in Wallace's 84th year. His conclusion was that life on Mars, by this he meant civil engineers with an interest in hydraulics, was impossible. He offered no opinion on microorganisms. Despite Wallace's critique, despite the fact that other astronomers with telescopes and observing sites as good as Lowell's could find no sign of the fabled canals, Lowell's vision of Mars gained popular acceptance. It had a mythic quality, as old as Genesis. Part of its appeal was the fact that the 19th century was an age of engineering marvels, including the construction of enormous canals. The Suez Canal, completed in 1869, the Corinth Canal in 1893, the Panama Canal in 1914, and closer to home, the Great Lake Locks, the barge canals of Upper New York State, and the irrigation canals of the American Southwest. If Europeans and Americans could perform such feats, why not Martians? Might there not be an even more elaborate effort by an older and wiser species courageously battling the advance of desiccation on the red planet? We have now sent reconnaissance satellites into orbit around Mars. The entire planet has been mapped. We have landed 2 automated laboratories on its surface. The mysteries of Mars have, if anything, deepened since Lowell's day. However, with pictures far more detailed than any view of Mars that Lowell could have glimpsed, we have found not a tributary of the vaunted canal network, not one lock. Lowell and Schiaparelli and others, doing visual observations under difficult seeing conditions, were misled, in part, perhaps because of a predisposition to believe in life on Mars. The observing notebooks of Percival Lowell reflect a sustained effort at the telescope over many years. They show Lowell to have been well aware of the skepticism expressed by other astronomers about the reality of the canals. They reveal a man convinced that he has made an important discovery and distressed that others have not yet understood its significance. In his notebook for 1905, for example, there is an entry on January 21. Double canals came out by flashes convincing of reality. In reading Lowell's notebooks, I have the distinct but uncomfortable feeling that he was really seeing something. But what? When Paul Fox of Cornell and I compared Lowell's maps of Mars with the Mariner 9 orbital imagery, sometimes with a resolution 1,000 times superior to that of Lowell's Earth-bound 24-inch refracting telescope, we found virtually no correlation at all. It was not that Lowell's eye had strung up disconnected fine detail on the Martian surface into illusory straight lines. There was no dark modeling or crater chains in the position of most of his canals. There were no features there at all. Then how could he have drawn the same canals year after year? How could other astronomers, some of whom said they had not examined Lowell's maps closely until after their own observations, have drawn the same canals? One of the great findings of the Mariner 9 mission to Mars was that there are time-variable streaks and splotches on the Martian surface, many connected with the ramparts of impact craters, which change with the seasons. They are due to wind-blown dust, the patterns varying with the seasonal winds. But the streaks do not have the character of the canals. They are not in the position of the canals, and none of them is large enough individually to be seen from the Earth in the first place. It is unlikely that there were real features on Mars even slightly resembling Lowell's canals in the first few decades of this century that have disappeared without a trace as soon as close-up spacecraft investigations became possible. The canals of Mars seem to be some malfunction under difficult seeing conditions of the human hand-eye-brain combination, or, at least for some humans, many other astronomers observing with equally good instruments in Lowell's time and after claimed there were no canals whatever. But this is hardly a comprehensive explanation, and I have the nagging suspicion that some essential feature of the Martian canal problem still remains undiscovered. Lowell always said that the regularity of the canals was an unmistakable sign that they were of intelligent origin. This is certainly true. The only unresolved question was which side of the telescope the intelligence was on. Lowell's Martians were benign and hopeful, even a little godlike. Very different from the malevolent menace posed by Wells and Wells in the War of the Worlds. Both sets of ideas passed into the public imagination through Sunday supplements and science fiction. I can remember as a child reading with breathless fascination the Mars novels of Edgar Rice Burroughs. I journeyed with John Carter, gentleman adventurer from Virginia to Barsoom, as Mars was known to its inhabitants. I followed herds of eight-legged beasts of burden, the Throats. I won the hand of the lovely Deja Thoris, princess of Helium. I befriended a four-meter-high green fighting man named Tars Tarkas. I wandered within the spired cities and domed pumping stations of Barsoom along the verdant banks of the Nilocirtis and Nepenthes canals. Might it really be possible, in fact, and not in fancy, to venture with John Carter to the kingdom of Helium on the planet Mars? Could we venture out on a summer evening, our way illuminated by the two hurtling moons of Barsoom, for a journey of high scientific adventure? Even if all Lowell's conclusions about Mars, including the existence of the fabled canals, turned out to be bankrupt, his depiction of the planet had at least this virtue. It aroused generations of eight-year-olds, myself among them, to consider the exploration of the planets as a real possibility, to wonder if we ourselves might one day voyage to Mars. John Carter got there by standing in an open field, spreading his hands and wishing. I can remember spending many an hour in my boyhood, arms resolutely outstretched in an empty field, imploring what I believed to be Mars to transport me there. It never worked. There had to be some other way. Like organisms, machines also have their evolutions. The rocket began like the gunpowder that first powered it in China, where it was used for ceremonial and aesthetic purposes. Imported to Europe around the 14th century, it was applied to warfare. Discussed in the late 19th century as a means of transportation to the planets by the Russian schoolteacher Konstantin Tsiolkovsky, and first developed seriously for high-altitude flight by the American scientist Robert Goddard. The German V-2 military rocket of World War II employed virtually all of Goddard's innovations and culminated in 1948 in the two-stage launching of the V-2 WAC Corporal combination to the then unprecedented altitude of 400 kilometers. In the 1950s, engineering advances organized by Sergei Korolev in the Soviet Union and Wernher von Braun in the United States, funded as delivery systems for weapons of mass destruction, led to the first artificial satellites. The pace of progress has continued to be brisk. Manned orbital flight, humans orbiting, then landing on the moon, and unmanned spacecraft outward bound throughout the solar system. Many other nations have now launched spacecraft, including Britain, France, Canada, Japan, and China, the society that invented the rocket in the first place. Among the early applications of the space rocket, as Tsiolkovsky and Goddard, who as a young man had read Wells and had been stimulated by the lectures of Percival Lowell, delighted in imagining, were an orbiting scientific station to monitor the Earth from a great height and a probe to search for life on Mars. Both of those dreams have now been fulfilled. Imagine yourself a visitor from some other and quite alien planet approaching Earth with no preconceptions. Your view of the planet improves as you come closer, and more fine detail stands out. Is the planet inhabited? At what point can you decide? If there are intelligent beings, perhaps they have created engineering structures that have high contrast components on a scale of a few kilometers, structures detectable when our optical systems and distance from the Earth provide kilometer resolution. Yet, at this level of detail, the Earth seems utterly barren. There is no sign of life, intelligent or otherwise, in places we call Washington, New York, Boston, Moscow, London, Paris, Berlin, Tokyo, and Peking. If there are intelligent beings on Earth, they have not much modified the landscape into regular geometrical patterns at kilometer resolution. But when we improve the resolution tenfold, when we begin to see detail as small as 100 meters across, the situation changes. Many places on Earth seems suddenly to crystallize out, revealing an intricate pattern of squares and rectangles, straight lines, and circles. There are, in fact, the engineering artifacts of intelligent beings: roads, highways, canals, farmland, city streets, a pattern disclosing the twin human passions for Euclidean geometry and territoriality. On this scale, intelligent life can be discerned in Boston and Washington and New York. And at 10-meter resolution, the degree to which the landscape has been reworked first really becomes evident. Humans have been very busy. These photos have been taken in daylight, but at twilight or during the night, other things are visible. Oil well fires in Libya and the Persian Gulf, deep water illumination by the Japanese squid fishing fleet, the bright lights of large cities. And if in daylight we improve our resolution so we can make out things that are a meter across, then we begin to detect for the first time individual organisms: whales, cows, flamingos, people. Intelligent life on Earth first reveals itself through the geometric regularity of its constructions. If Lowell's canal network really existed, the conclusion that intelligent beings inhabit Mars might be similarly compelling. For life to be detected on Mars photographically, even from Mars orbit, it must likewise have accomplished a major reworking of the surface. Technical civilizations, canal builders, might be easy to detect, but except for one or two enigmatic features, nothing of the sort is apparent in the exquisite profusion of Martian surface detail uncovered by unmanned spacecraft. However, there are many other possibilities, ranging from large plants and animals to microorganisms to extinct forms to a planet that is now and was always lifeless. Because Mars is farther from the sun than is the Earth, its temperatures are considerably lower. Its air is thin, containing mostly carbon dioxide, but also some molecular nitrogen and argon, and very small quantities of water vapor, oxygen, and ozone. Open bodies of liquid water are impossible today because the atmospheric pressure on Mars is too low to keep even cold water from rapidly boiling. There may be minute quantities of liquid water in pores and capillaries in the soil. The amount of oxygen is far too little for a human being to breathe. The ozone abundance is so small that germicidal ultraviolet radiation from the sun strikes the Martian surface unimpeded. Could any organism survive in such an environment? To test this question, many years ago, my colleagues and I prepared chambers that simulated the Martian environment as it was then known, inoculated them with terrestrial microorganisms, and waited to see if anybody survived. Such chambers are called, of course, Mars jars. The Mars jars cycled the temperatures within a typical Martian range from a little above the freezing point around noon to about minus 80 degrees centigrade just before dawn, in an anoxic atmosphere composed chiefly of CO2 and N2. Ultraviolet lamps reproduced the fierce solar flux. No liquid water was present except for very thin films wetting individual sand grains. Some microbes froze to death after the first night and were never heard from again. Others gasped and perished from lack of oxygen. Some died of thirst, and some were fried by the ultraviolet light. But there was always a fair number of varieties of terrestrial microbes that did not need oxygen, that temporarily closed up shop when the temperatures dropped too low, that hid from the ultraviolet light under pebbles or thin layers of sand. In other experiments, when small quantities of liquid water were present, the microbes actually grew. If terrestrial microbes can survive the Martian environment, how much better Martian microbes, if they exist, must do on Mars? But first, we must get there. The Soviet Union maintains an active program of unmanned planetary exploration. Every year or two, the relative positions of the planets and the physics of Kepler and Newton permit the launch of a spacecraft to Mars or Venus with a minimum expenditure of energy. Since the early 1960s, the USSR has missed few such opportunities. Soviet persistence and engineering skills have eventually paid off handsomely. 5 Soviet spacecraft, Veneras 8 through 12, have landed on Venus and successfully returned data from the surface. No insignificant feat in so hot, dense, and corrosive a planetary atmosphere. Yet, despite many attempts, the Soviet Union has never landed successfully on Mars, a place that, at least at first sight, seems more hospitable, with chilly temperatures, a much thinner atmosphere, and more benign gases, with polar ice caps, clear, pink skies, great sand dunes, ancient riverbeds, a vast rift valley, the largest volcanic construct so far as we know in the solar system, and balmy equatorial summer afternoons, a far more Earth-like world than Venus. In 1971, the Soviet Mars 3 spacecraft entered the Martian atmosphere. According to the information automatically radioed back, it successfully deployed its landing systems during entry, correctly oriented its ablation shield downward, properly unfurled its great parachute, and fired its retro rockets near the end of its descent path. According to the data returned by Mars 3, it should have landed successfully on the Red Planet. But after landing, the spacecraft returned a 20-second fragment of featureless television picture to Earth and then mysteriously failed. In 1973, a quite similar sequence of events occurred with the Mars 6 lander, in that case the failure occurring within 1 second of touchdown. What went wrong? The first illustration I ever saw of Mars 3 was on a Soviet postage stamp, denomination 16 kopecks, which depicted the spacecraft descending through a kind of purple muck. The artist was trying, I think, to illustrate dust and high winds. Mars 3 had entered the Martian atmosphere during an enormous global dust storm. We have evidence from the U.S. Mariner 9 mission that near-surface winds of more than 140 meters per second, faster than half the speed of sound on Mars, arose in that storm. Both our Soviet colleagues and we think it likely that these high winds caught the Mars 3 spacecraft with the parachute unfurled so that it landed gently in the vertical direction, but with breakneck speed in the horizontal direction. A spacecraft descending on the shrouds of a large parachute is particularly vulnerable to horizontal winds. After landing, Mars 3 may have made a few bounces, hit a boulder or other example of Martian relief, tipped over, lost the radio link with its carrier bus, and failed. But why did Mars 3 enter in the midst of a great dust storm? The Mars 3 mission was rigidly organized before launch. Every step it was to perform was loaded into the onboard computer before it left Earth. There was no opportunity to change the computer program, even as the extent of the great 1971 dust storm became clear. In the jargon of space exploration, the Mars 3 mission was pre-programmed, not adaptive. The failure of Mars 6 is more mysterious. There was no planet-wide storm when this spacecraft entered the Martian atmosphere, and no reason to suspect a local storm, as sometimes happens at the landing site. Perhaps there was an engineering failure just at the moment of touchdown, or perhaps there is something particularly dangerous about the Martian surface. The combination of Soviet successes in landing on Venus and Soviet failures in landing on Mars naturally caused us some concern about the U.S. Viking mission, which had been informally scheduled to set one of its 2 descent craft gently down on the Martian surface on the bicentennial of the United States, July 4, 1976. Like its Soviet predecessors, the Viking landing maneuver involved an ablation shield, a parachute, and retro rockets. Because the Martian atmosphere is only 1% as dense as the Earth's, a very large parachute, 18 meters in diameter, was deployed to slow the spacecraft as it entered the thin air of Mars. The atmosphere is so thin that if Viking had landed at a high elevation, there would not have been enough atmosphere to break the descent adequately, and it would have crashed. One requirement, therefore, was for a landing site in a low-lying region. From Mariner 9 results and ground-based radar studies, we knew many such areas. To avoid the probable fate of Mars 3, we wanted Viking to land in a place and time at which the winds were low. Winds that would make the lander crash were probably strong enough to lift dust off the surface. If we could check that the candidate landing site was not covered with sifting, drifting dust, we would have at least a fair chance of guaranteeing that the winds were not intolerably high. This was one reason that each Viking lander was carried into Mars orbit with its orbiter, and descent delayed until the orbiter surveyed the landing site. We had discovered, with Mariner 9, that characteristic changes in the bright and dark patterns on the Martian surface occurred during times of high winds. We certainly would not have certified a Viking landing site as safe if orbital photographs had shown such shifting patterns. But our guarantees could not be 100% reliable. For example, we could imagine a landing site at which the winds were so strong that all mobile dust had already been blown away. We would then have had no indication of the high winds that might have been there. Detailed weather predictions for Mars were, of course, much less reliable than for Earth. Indeed, one of the many objectives of the Viking mission was to improve our understanding of the weather on both planets. Because of communication and temperature constraints, Viking could not land at high Martian latitudes. Farther poleward than about 45 or 50 degrees in both hemispheres, either the time or useful communication of the spacecraft with the Earth or the period during which the spacecraft would avoid dangerously low temperatures would have been awkwardly short. We did not wish to land in too rough a place. The spacecraft might have tipped over and crashed, or at least its mechanical arm, intended to acquire Martian soil samples, might have become wedged or been left waving helplessly a meter too high above the surface. Likewise, we did not want to land in places that were too soft. If the spacecraft's three landing pods had sunk deeply into a loosely packed soil, various undesirable consequences would have followed, including immobilization of the sample arm. But we did not want to land in a place that was too hard either. Had we landed in a vitreous lava field, for example, with no powdery surface material, the mechanical arm would have been unable to acquire the samples vital to the projected chemistry and biology experiments. The best photographs then available of Mars from the Martian 9 orbiter showed features no smaller than 90 meters, 100 yards, across. The Viking orbiter pictures improved this figure only slightly. Boulders 1 meter, 3 feet, in size were entirely invisible in such photographs and could have had disastrous consequences for the Viking lander. Likewise, a deep, soft powder might have been indetectable photographically.